That's true. And they do come around. They have come around until we started discouraging that kind of activity with, you know, the suitcases of debt.
Right.
And, you know, on analysis, it just didn't look like a good deal.
No, well, it's a credit to you for being able to walk away from whatever temptations are on the plus side of any sort of a merger or a takeover.
Well, I really love what we do, and I work with the most wonderful people, and it's always interesting. There's endless novelty. Every job is different. Every challenge is different. There's all these problems to solve. When you run out, there's more.
Right.
As someone who loves novelty, there's more going on than I could possibly invent. I have an alternate career. I'm a writer. So the temptation would be to put in full time doing that. But meanwhile, there were more stories happening that are more exciting than what I can invent. So that's why I'm still here.
You've been with Art Graf Strauss your whole life?
Only 20 years. That makes me a short timer here. We've got a lot of 30-year people.
Uh-huh. How did you come to this business and this specific company?
It is a family business. My grandfather came to work for Mr. Strauss in 1903 as a porter, and he soon rose to foreman, and a number of years later, he ended up taking over the company. My grandfather was an inventor as well as a businessman, which is as rare a combination as, say, poet and businessman or dancer and businessman. It's an unusual combination.
The two don't normally inhabit the same universe.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. One is very abstract, and one is very connected to the real world.
How many patents did he earn during his life?
Well, you know, he claimed that he invented the self-starter for the automobile, and the Morris chair, which is a chair that you lean back in and the feet go up. Mm-hmm. And he was a kid at the time. So he said, you know, the patent lawyer ended up with it. Well, the self-starter was sold to Pierce Arrow. He said he got $50. But he was always great at meeting challenges. In World War II, when signs could not be lit by electricity, he would capture ambient light by using those little wiggly mirrors. You know the wiggly mirrors? You see them on car washes?
Sure.
He invented that thing.
That's universal. You see them everywhere.
Yes. Well, that's the trouble with a lot of our inventions. They're not like inventing the internal combustion engine. They're more like inventing how to put the wheels and the seats and the body and the transmission all together to make a car. So we're always applying something from one technology to the display technology. Another thing that Grandpa came up with was the smoking machine for the smoking camel sign.
That was him?
That was him.
That was my introduction to New York City.
Oh, really? You remember that sign?
Oh, sure I do. When I was before I was even in school, my folks were taking me over there for one thing or another because we only lived across the river, and they loved New York. And that was the first thing they did was take me to Times Square and pointed out that sign. It became an iron later on, I think. Something, anything that blew steam was used for that. But I remember the camel.
Yeah, there's something very interesting about that because it's an example of how image is stronger than reality. A lot of people claim to have seen that sign who cannot possibly have seen it because it came down in 1964. Mm-hmm. So whenever somebody 25 years old says they saw it, I say, I don't think so.
Unfortunately for you, I am well past.
but that is the most famous sign of all time. There was something about the way those smoke rings came out of the plane of the sign and went floating over the, you know, over the traffic. The smoke rings stayed intact for hundreds of feet, and it wasn't really smoke; it was steam that we bought from Con Edison.
Mm-hmm. I loved the way the city was moving at such a pace, and everybody was hustling, but those smoke rings were just kind of waft. And everything slowed down if you looked up.
There was something very soothing about it.
Yes, it was.
These displays have a powerful emotional component, even today. It's technology, yes, but it's also something that appeals to the kid in us. There's something about the way they are surrealistically large, which makes you feel like a tot. And there's something toy-like about them. Now, of course, information has become the big commodity. It's become the consumer item that is everybody's obsession. So information is the thing. It's the imagery. So all the information is jumping around. And I suppose that's so popular at the moment because it makes people feel intelligent.
Without a doubt. Artcraft Strauss, really, because of its position, I would imagine, is responsible for a lot of the imagery that people have of New York City, and they take home with them. You're a global company, though, even though you are a family, aren't you?
We've exported signs to places as far away as Africa. We have a sign in Nigeria. We sent one to Iceland. We've sent signs to South America. But we are pretty much regional, really. More than 99% of our work is here in the New York area. Mm-hmm. We're known way beyond the immediate market because some of the things, like the Smoking Camel sign or like the Flying A and Eagle for Anheuser-Busch, were replicated around the country and around the world.
What would you say your proudest achievement is in the time you've been there, the most memorable one?
Well,
if you had to choose one of your favorite kids.
If I had to choose a favorite kid, it would be saving Times Square from the development that was going to turn it all into just another faceless downtown. All the signs were going to be eliminated. They were considered passé, and I don't know what, bourgeois.
This wasn't that many years ago, was it?
It was in the mid-1980s. Mm-hmm. And development in New York was moving west, and all the low buildings, which have all of these delightful rooftops that have served as the platforms for the displays, were going to come down and be replaced by giant office towers. So I organized demonstrations in which we turned off all of the lights in Times Square. We had the Municipal Arts Society and the American Institute of Architects and even the Sierra Club. All kinds of civic organizations got together to make a coalition, and they did the talking. But behind the scenes, we had electricians in all the signs, and one by one, at two-second intervals, we turned them all off. They went down like dominoes. And then with Times Square all in the dark, all of these articulate people got up and said, this is what Times Square will look like without the lights. And this got the attention of the press, and from there, the attention of the people, and from there, the attention of the politicians who had the power to say, wait a minute, let's keep the lights on.
Let me comb your memory bank on that for a minute and just try and establish what they were thinking when they thought that the signs were passé, that they weren't necessary anymore.
Well, they were thinking that the whole Times Square thing was passé, that cleaning up Times Square would rid the place of its denizens, And you know, Times Square at that time in the late 70s and early 80s had a kind of raffish, to put it nicely, aura. It was always a kind of edgy place, but it was down at the heels, and there were all sorts of undesirable persons hanging out there. Of course, you know, when that kind of talk started going around, apart from its racist implications, I mean, we all started calling ourselves denizens. And, hey, I'm a denizen, and I'm proud of it. But the idea was to knock down all the honky-tonk stuff, all of the, there were X-rated movies, souvenir stores, and, you know, junky-looking stuff that offended the office worker sensibility, knock it all down and replace it with office towers. And then it would be nice and clean and safe and sort of suburban. Of course, it would also be dead after 6 p.m.
And absolutely sterile.
Yes. It would be just another faceless place, you know, very dehumanizing. So the lights are symbolic of all of that, of the mixed use, you know, the highly democratic environment, the 24-hour-a-day action, the, you know, the rhythm, you know, the beat of the city. And that's something that did not deserve to be consigned to history. Usually people don't realize that they're losing something until it's already gone.
That's very true.
This was a very rare case when we were able to dramatize what people were about to lose. Just by dint of turning off those lights.
Begin to take it for granted, and then it's not there. There have been times through the entire course of the time that the company has been in operation where outdoor signage has been an issue. It's clogging up the landscape. It's too bright. It's too showy. We need to tone it down. We need to change it. Someone will always find a way to want to adjust it. How do you deal with these on a case-by-case basis? Are there kind of cyclical things that go on where people are looking to fine-tune what you're doing? And how do you respond to that?
Well, there's always an impulse by the government especially, but also by lots of people to just manage everything. You know, I guess on a philosophical level, that you know they'd find comfort in the notion that everything is controlled. You know, that somebody's in charge, whereas capitalism and the market thrives when it's, you know, like people thrive when they're given a little more room to grow and to be creative. Of course, there has to be some control. I wouldn't like to build a you know, a waste management facility in my, you know, backyard.
Right.
And in fact, bright and flashing glitter and lights don't belong in every neighborhood. They belong in commercial neighborhoods. So it's about having a more sophisticated view of environmentalism. It's unsophisticated to say all signs are bad, all lights are bad. It's just as unsophisticated to say that they're all good. But within the context, things are appropriate in one context that are not appropriate in another. So in a dignified office area, like on Park Avenue, it may not be appropriate to blow smoke rings and dance up and down and, have dancing babes and all that kind of stuff. But in an entertainment district, it is very appropriate to have things that are cheerful and funny and maybe even a little tiny bit risque.
Archive Strauss is really to be credited for doing one thing and doing it well and doing it consistently. And I think that that must have a lot to do with why the company. It's 105 years this year, right?
No, that's right.
Has there been a temptation to branch out into a lot of other areas and kind of dilute what you're doing, or has the focus always been we're going to do this, and we're going to stay with this and maintain the integrity of it.
Well, we're lucky as far as the boredom quotient is concerned in that what we do has so many different components and so many different aspects. Building big signs, especially spectacular signs, has in it elements of real estate, construction, advertising, entertainment, politics, technology. We have unions. We have everything. I think we have everything except food. So there's the processing of information. There's always something new to learn. So the niche consists of putting all of these apparently disparate elements together to make a construction that will make people go, wow. So that alone is challenging enough.
There is no need to go outside of that.
No, because it's endless because of all the combinations and all the new technology. Each corporation who buys a big spectacular has its unique personality to convey. So the Coca-Cola company, for example, they needed something to express their own uniqueness and their iconic position in, I was going to say American life, but in global life. And they didn't know exactly what they wanted. They just wanted something dazzling. So we got to work with them and think about the image until we came up with these three-dimensional ice cubes with strobe lights in them and the bottle with the cap coming off and all of these animated effects, all in the service of this particular image. A corporation is as unique as an individual person. It really has a personality. And yep. That's what we get to express in these very unforgiving materials. It's glass and metal and wires. But in the end, there's something that goes way beyond that. It's a very artistic and creative and fun and challenging thing to do.
How many people are employed by the company now, Ms. Starr?
About 75.
All in New York?
All in New York.
And 100. I understand that there are some special observances you're going to undertake for marking 105 years?
Oh, we have just moved after 75 years in a really old factory. Factory got old over near the river. We've moved our headquarters to a townhouse on East 22nd Street, and we moved the factory to a new-ish building out in Maspeth, Queens. So we're having our grand opening, housewarming, and all of that this coming June.
You going to invite the neighborhood?
Yes. Open house.
Wonderful. It's going to be an unusual event.
Yes, it is.
Nobody really gets to look inside of the works of basically any company. How did that come to mind?
Well, it was just time to move on. It was getting very expensive to keep a factory going in Manhattan. And it was just time for a move. And meanwhile, we had the offices, the design and sales above the factory. It's like living over the store. So by moving into this townhouse, we get to express the, a lot of philosophical things. This house is 150 years old, but it's completely modernized. So that's sort of an expression of us. And meanwhile, in the back of the house, there's a two-story atrium, which we've turned into a gallery of signs. So we're bringing over some neon and fiber optics and LEDs and things that we're setting up in the back. And the sign painters painted the entire gallery to look like twilight. The top is a dark purple, and it gets lighter and lighter towards the bottom. So it's like that magical moment when the twilight descends and the signs, the lights are just coming on.
It's the best time of the day. That's magnificent.
That beautiful moment, and the sign painters. There were still people who know how to paint signs. They actually caught that beautiful orchid color, and were hanging all kinds of sign things around. It's really going to be interesting. I've never seen anything like it.
The company is 105 years old, Miss Starr. No. Somebody is going to be sitting in your seat 100 years from now. What kind of vision do you have that's going to help propel the company to that next century?
Well, first of all, I hope that person has as much fun and intellectual excitement as I'm having. And I would say that for success, they should hold on to their roots in the 19th century with those wonderful 19th century values as they move on into the, what's it going to be, the 22nd century, 23rd century. In other words, to keep hold of the loyalty and the integrity and the craftsmanship, all of those things that used to be common currency 100 years ago, they are completely compatible with the newest technology.
The old values never go out of style.
They do not.